And we will go on to our next case. And our next case is 082145, Fred Seifert versus Dominic Spiner Foods.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. Christopher Krueger on behalf of appellant Fred Seifert. I'd like at the outset to begin to address the procedural controversy in this case, which is, of course, did Judge Anderson abuse his discretion when extending the time to file appeal? Federal rules reject the approach that pleading is a game of skill in which one misstep by counsel may be decisive to the outcome, and accept the principle that the purpose of pleading is to facilitate a proper decision on the merits, Conley v. Gibson. And we're, of course, asserting that that's good law. I believe there's two schools of thought on procedural application, and I don't propose to say anything to dispose of the debate. But I will offer several observations on why a flexibility in applying a rule like Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4A5 to avoid second-guessing district judges on procedural matters, for the fact that there will be cases that need to be heard and that this court will want to hear, and they may be foreclosed if there's too rigid an application of the rules. Also, of course, the application of the rules based on the definition of excusable neglect, and the court will decide just what excusable neglect means applied to this these facts. But excusable neglect has the same definition throughout the federal procedural domain, so whatever standard you set for excusable neglect will have a ripple effect throughout federal law. I can say that from my perspective reviewing case law regarding extensions of time to appeal, I will say in virtually all the cases reviewed, the party with more resources generally triumphed over the party with the lesser resources. And the exception that makes that rule true is the state of Wisconsin and Lac des Flambeaux versus Wisconsin, where the state of Wisconsin was denied their appeal. And that's about all I have to say with the procedural matter, with the exception that the concurrence by Judge Flaum in the case Vorhall talks about the incentive for knowing the rules is not created by giving one party the benefit of both parties' mistake. Alternatively, and I paraphrase, the other party knew the rules all along and attempted to gain advantage by keeping silent, while the appellant erroneously relied on the judge and then sprung the deadline on him once it was passed. I think, and being a participant in this matter, I think that analogizes well to the situation in this case. We have a rule that's designed and presupposes people are going to file appeals late. It gives judges discretion to allow appellants to do that in the in equitable interests, and I think it should be extended to the appellant in this case. Now, going to the substantive portion of the case, did the appellant present enough evidence to survive summary judgment? And the appellant was disciplined for two interactions in the workplace. We submit that we have colorable evidence that, in the first instance, Seifert was the victim of stereotyping, and regarding his age, regarding his gender. We question Dominic's application of their own policy Their own policy at that time contained a clause which encouraged people who felt offended to confront their offenders. And that's a dispute resolution tool, and it's acknowledged as a pretty good method that you try to resolve conflicts at the lowest level. Had that policy been adhered to, we might not be before the Seventh Circuit this morning.
It's not a mandatory policy, though, is it?
No, it's not a mandatory policy.
It can be pretty intimidating for someone who feels they've been harassed to have to face-to-face confront that harasser.
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor. But I also think that we have a concession in McDonald v. Cisneros that sex harassment policies do generally inure to the benefit of women, and that's not a bad thing. But the law asks us to view people in more than one attribute. And when we just routinely apply the McDonnell-Douglas paradigm over and over and over again, we don't really view people. We view people as what I call two-dimensional. And I think the McDonnell-Douglas paradigm is a good thing, was a good thing for eradicating blatant discrimination and a Jim Crow type of segregation. But I think the law asked us to do so much more. It asked us to view people according to their gender, according to their age, according to their religion. It asks a lot. And yet when we analyze these cases, we don't trust juries to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. We don't trust them to look at people with various characteristics.
Did Seifert ever lodge any formal complaint with Dominick's against any co-worker, any of his co-workers for discrimination based on religion or sex or age?
Seifert called Ed Cohen on the telephone the night after
I know that.
Well, if you call that formal or informal, that was his reporting of a religious controversy. I think the record reflects that there's at least as good a chance that there's an argument implicating religion and religious bigotry and people calling Seifert a blasphemer. And I think that introduces another wrinkle to this case.
Well, since he admitted the majority of the behavior in the two claims that were lodged against him, is it really all that relevant why the women chose to complain? In other words, unless there is evidence that the decision makers themselves harbored the anti-Semitic attitude that Mr. Seifert attributes to Hoffman and Berkman, he has a real problem with standing summary judgment, doesn't he?
Well, Justice Rovner, I suppose the way I would counter that is to say, is Seifert's Jewishness any less protected? And as we note in Cisneros, we know that sexual harassment policies protect women. If there's culpable evidence that there's another implication, can the employer disregard it simply because he has a written policy regarding gender? Religion's no, gender is not a super status.
I'm not certain that my question is being responded to. What I'm trying to get at is that unless you have some evidence of the decision makers harboring anti-Semitic attitudes, does it really matter why the women chose to complain about something that, admittedly, Mr. Seifert admits?
I see now, Judge Rovner. What the contention is that Dominick's would rather, or the path of less resistance is to rid themselves of Seifert than to go around investigating religious arguments. So rather than to delve into Seifert's contentions were discarded, and he was discarded. And whether it's not so much anti-Semitism on Cohen's part, but a desire to not open a can of worms in the workplace. But if that inures to Seifert's detriment because of his religion, then it's discriminatory action by the employer.
Well, I mean, what evidence is there of a cover-up? You know, in your brief, you maintain that Dominick's went to pains to cover up the so-called Bible argument. What evidence is there of a cover-up? Ellen admitted that Seifert's co-workers had mentioned the discussion, correct?
Yes. Yes, he did.
What's the evidence of the cover-up?
That they did not interview Lynn Hussein, who is the person who inquired as to Seifert's status, Jewish religion, shortly after the argument, and with one of the accusers in the workplace. So people were asking about Seifert's religion. It was it was evidence that there was a religious controversy, that the religion was an element of the workplace dispute. And yet, because we have a sex harassment policy, it seems that that provides a out instead of examining all the participants, interviewing all the participants, and gathering evidence regarding his countercharge. In the Flanagan, Cisneros, these other cases, it's stated that an overzealous investigation cannot be grounds for a counter charge of sex harassment. Well, can a thin investigation, can a the paucity of that investigation be the basis for a counterclaim? And we assert it can, and we assert that there's at least as much evidence that there was argument about religion, and that was the motivation, and that Dominick's was well aware of that controversy. I have nothing further.
Morning, Ms. Hall.
Morning.
May it please
right straight off the bat. Why did you fail to object to Seifert's late Rule 59e motion in the district court?
Your Honor, we failed to inform the court in the hearing about the lateness of Mr. Seifert's motion because the court stated that what it would do is consider the motion on the merits, and if it found that there was a reason to go any further, it would give us the opportunity to object to that motion or to file a reply. Instead, the court went right ahead and issued a decision that said there was no reason to overturn its summary judgment decision. Further, Your Honor, counsel for Dominick's informed Mr. Seifert on March 31st via email, which is in the record at number 84, Exhibit A, that it would not agree to any extensions of time for the Rule 59E filing. So while there is evidence that we did not make the statement to the district court, we were not provided with the opportunity to respond to the motion, and we had informed Mr. Seifert that we would not agree to the extension he requested.
You know, terminating him based on these two incidents seems unusually harsh. Do you have examples of other employees who have been terminated for similar conduct?
There were no examples in the record, Your Honor, that anyone else had been accused of sexual harassment.
In all of Dominick's?
Your Honor, it's not in the record, but the way the discovery requests were posed, that was the answer provided. So we don't have anyone else other than Mr. Seifert to look at as far as the application of Dominick's sexual harassment policy. Mr. Seifert points to an individual he calls a comparator, Tony Mensick. Mr. Mensick was a pharmacy manager who had a different title and different responsibilities than Mr. Seifert, and the stool sample joke Mr. Seifert accuses him of telling was not sexual, and no one complained about it. That is the only reasonable comparator Mr. Seifert had, and he did not establish that that individual was similarly situated to him.
Now, once he raised the issue of the religious discussion that he had with Hoffman and Berkman, did Ellis ever interview either one of them again to confirm or refute Seifert's allegations of religious discrimination?
Your Honor, there are two points to that. First, I believe Mr. Seifert's deposition reflects that Mr. Ellen told him that he spoke to those women about their comments, but they were unrelated to their complaints. In addition, Your Honor, as you noted, the fact that those two women might have even been motivated to complain about Mr. Seifert because of what he calls religious discrimination is not pertinent. Mr. Seifert admitted to the conduct for which he was fired. Dominick's has asserted that he was terminated for mentioning masturbation at work after he was informed of the company's sexual harassment policy. 6 weeks after being informed of that policy, he made the comment. He admitted that he did so to the decision makers, and therefore Dominick's determined that he should be terminated for his second violation under the policy.
You know, it just seemed extremely odd that he didn't hear anything from Dominick's for well over a month after his May 22nd meeting with Ellen and Cohen. Was he suspended at that time or otherwise formally disciplined? What's the standard protocol in such a situation?
Under Dominick's sexual harassment policy, the company undertakes an investigation into the conduct of which the individual is accused and then determines what they're going to do about that individual. Mr. Seifert was suspended during the time of Dominick's investigation, and director of pharmacy Cohen, Matt Allen, who was in Human Resources, and the head of the Human Resources Department were all involved in that investigation and came to the conclusion in July that he would be terminated.
Did Cohen supervise Seifert directly? Did he supervise any other Jewish pharmacists?
We do not have any evidence in the record as to the religion of anyone else whom Mr. Cohen supervised. But, yes, Mr. Cohen did directly supervise Mr. Seifert.
And one more. Is there any evidence in the record, in addition to Ellen's word, that Seifert received a copy of the sexual harassment policy?
Mr. Seifert himself admits that he received and saw a copy of that policy, and it's Exhibit 5 in his deposition, which is in the record at number 41. Your Honors, the District Court made two errors of law in granting Mr. Seifert's Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4A5 request for an extension of time to appeal. First, the District Court erroneously used the good cause standard when evaluating Mr. Seifert's request, when, under the law of this Court, it should have used the excusable neglect standard. On that basis alone, this Court should find that the District Court abused its discretion. In addition, the District Court erroneously concluded that it could toll the time period for Mr. Seifert's appeal by retroactively sanctioning his late and improper Rule 59E filing. The Court stated that it intended, at the time Mr. Seifert filed his Rule 59E memo on April 4th, well after the 10-day period provided by Rule 59 had expired, that the appeal period would be tolled until it ruled on that motion. However, Rule 6B in the precedent of this Court specifically provides that such extensions are improper, and the District Court's retroactive sanctioning of that improperly filed motion is an abuse of discretion. In addition, although Mr. Seifert only addressed it briefly, he has failed to show excusable neglect. Excusable neglect is reserved for those situations in which the rules are ambiguous or the Court has made a misrepresentation to a party about, for example, whether a filing is timely. The rules here are clear. Rule 59 provides that a party has 10 days from the entry of a judgment to file a motion for reconsideration, and that motion, according to Rule 7B1, must state with particularity the basis for the motion. Rule 6B prohibits extensions of time to that 10-day period, but that is exactly what Mr. Seifert asked for. He filed a skeletal motion on March 27th, and then supplemented that motion with a memorandum on April 4th, in which he set forth his arguments for reconsideration. On that basis, the clarity of the rules and the precedents of this Court cannot find excusable neglect. Furthermore, unlike in the cases Mr. Seifert cites in his brief, the district court did not make any misrepresentation as to the timeliness of his filing. Rather, it simply accepted his motion electronically and his memorandum electronically and then ruled on the merits.
Do you agree that what he filed on April 4th, had it been filed within that 10-day period, would have been a sufficient motion under Rule 59?
Yes, we do, Your Honor, because in that motion he filed on April 4th, he set out his specific arguments in support of his position. But in the papers he filed within the 10-day period, he simply said that he had run into some personal conflicts and because of the holiday had not had sufficient time to set forth his arguments for reconsideration. And this court has previously rejected such statements.
But the April 4th filing was within 30 days of the judgment, correct?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. In addition, Mr. Seifert's argument of inexperience, which he spends a significant amount of time in his brief going over, fails. As he admits in his brief at page 3, he did not raise the issue of his inexperience to the court below, and he cannot rely on it here to establish excusable neglect and that the court did not abuse its discretion in granting his Rule 4A5 motion. Turning to the merits of Mr. Seifert's case, as this court noted, Mr. Seifert has left out one key issue in his brief and here today. He admitted to the conduct for which he was terminated. He specifically admits that he referenced masturbation at work after being warned about the company's policy. That is the reason for which Dominick's terminated him, and therefore he cannot show that he was discriminated against, and he cannot establish pretext. Moreover, the statements which Mr. Seifert claims are admissions by his supervisor, Ed Cohen, which he referenced earlier, are simply not. Those statements about not surrounding himself with Jewish employees were not made in reference to Mr. Seifert or his termination and are not direct evidence of discrimination. And as we already discussed, Mr. Seifert did not show indirect evidence of discrimination because he did not identify a proper comparator. Further, he was not meeting the company's legitimate expectations at the time of his termination, and he can't show his prima facie case. Moreover, Mr. Seifert's pretext argument fails. Mr. Seifert has suggested, both in his brief and today, that Dominick's investigation into his conduct was deficient, but Dominick's followed its policy. While Mr. Seifert has focused on the fact that the individuals who accused him of sexual harassment did not confront him about it, as this court has recognized, the policy only encourages such confrontations and does not require them. The fact that no one confronted him does not show pretext, nor is it evidence of discrimination. Moreover, Dominick's investigated the complaints against Mr. Seifert. They talked to the two women who accused him of misconduct and got written statements from those two women, which are in the record. And Mr. Seifert confirmed that he made the inappropriate comment, as they alleged. Accordingly, Dominick's terminated him for violating their policy. And unless there are any other questions on the merits, I'd like to discuss the final issue in this case, which is whether the lower court improperly denied Mr. Seifert's motion to alter or amend. At the outset, Mr. Seifert did not proffer any specific arguments relating to that order in his opening brief and addressed it only in his reply. He did mention it in his notice of appeal, but based on his perfunctory arguments here and in his reply brief, that his appeal as to that order has been waived. Further, the district court properly denied his Rule 59 motion to alter or amend. As Mr. Seifert admits in his reply brief at page 11, the arguments that he proffered in support of that motion are essentially the same as the arguments he put forth on the merits in his summary judgment response. This court has held that proffering the same arguments in a motion to reconsider as you did on the merits is improper. In addition, because the district court properly ruled in Dominick's favor on its summary judgment motion, it cannot be found that the district court abused its discretion in denying Mr. Seifert's motion to alter or amend. Accordingly, Dominick's respectfully requests that this court find it lacks jurisdiction over Mr. Seifert's appeal of the summary judgment order, if this court does look at that decision to affirm it, and that this court affirm the decision of the district court in denying Mr. Seifert's motion to alter or amend.
Thank you, Ms. Hall. Ruther, you have 2.5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. Is there any lower boundary for an employer's investigation? In Malik, it says it's not a gratuitous undertaking. We've taken away state tort claims from people. We've taken away the counterclaim of an investigation being sexual harassment in and of itself in Flanagan and Cisneros. When you look at the investigatory, so-called investigatory materials, religion is invisible. There is no reference to it. The statement, "I don't surround myself with Jews, I don't have Jews on my office staff," the pretty strong words, and the words of a person who eschews controversy. And this is what we're bringing, and this is what we say a jury is competent to decide a multifaceted case. Fred Seifert admitted to the comments made, the comments by certainly Baskerville standards are innocuous or nothing that you couldn't hear on late night television. That's not to say that someone can't be terminated under a policy, but his status is entitled to the same protection as the gender status of the accusers. So we just feel that there's not evidence that they delved into this and found any kind of bottom line in this, and that they essentially eschewed it. Your Honor pointed out that it seems unusually harsh to terminate a degreed professional with 8 years of a relatively uneventful employment, and we submit that's fine, because it's easier to terminate a part-time 70-year-old than to mix it up with people in the workplace who are evangelicals and have a biased against Cipher based on his religion. And we just think that 1992, we have an instruction from Congress that juries are supposed to hear these cases. We have an instruction from Congress that says a little bit of discrimination isn't okay. Mixed motive, even if it's a portion of the employer's motivation, that we should address that. And we'd just like to see that addressed, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.